So let's get started. I titled today's presentation, "What Did They Say About Climate Change in 1814?" So it's not maybe too much of a spoiler to give the short answer to that, which is they didn't really say anything directly back at that time, but there were advances happening that contribute to the way that we understand it now. So I'll show you the next slide. This is my "Here I Stand" slide, and I'm a science geek. I approach this all from the standpoint of science. Al Gore didn't put me up to anything, so different people might think that that's a good or a bad thing. Climate change is real and it's a threat, but there's room to argue about how big the threat is, and especially when you get down to very specific things. So my specialty is about the influences on Great Lakes water levels, and there is room for argument in that arena. And then there's room to argue about what to do. So again, I'm a science geek. I have ideas about what to do, but it's not my final say on political action. It's not about capitalism being evil, it's about science, or at least for me it is. So I guess part of my goal here is to connect between the scientific understanding of climate change and the observations of it, and then politics. So potential analog between thinking about climate change and biblical criticism. So I'm quoting from John Shelby Spong here, and he says that in his experience, there's an unspoken assumption that the Bible dropped from heaven, fully written, divided into chapters and verses, and if they're English speaking, it's in the King James edition. And some people treat the idea of climate change that way, that it came to us fully formed, and that there are certain things to believe. And actually, Spong goes on to say that a lot of the people who think that they're literally believing the Bible really don't understand what's in there and are just kind of inserting what they think is in there. And in the arena of climate change, that can lead to distortions really from both the climate change believers and the deniers. Mostly from the deniers, but we'll talk about that a little bit. So climate change science didn't emerge fully formed. Underlying concepts date back a very long time. And in order to understand climate change as being human-caused, you have to put both the theory and the observations together. One of those alone doesn't mean that it exists and is human caused, and we'll talk a little bit more about this this word theory too. It doesn't mean exactly what a lot of the public thinks. So there is potential for newer added knowledge and perspective, and a lot of scientists keep adding their own little pieces to the whole puzzle. But it must be approached with care and humility. So the grumpy scientist here gets anxious when amateurs start putting in what they think. So in order to draw outside the lines in a constructive way, you first really have to understand what the lines are. So in this case, you need to understand the science and why we think that things are happening in a certain way. So some of my experiences in the past are, one particular guy I know says, well, I think it's that we're moving through a hot part of the Milky Way galaxy. And yeah, you know, that's just pulled out of nowhere. So it's about science, not bias or knee-jerk reactions. So some of the things from the observational side, these first two I think are quite compelling. First one is every month from March 1985 to July 2014, which was the last available when I came here from home, they have been warmer than the 20th century mean. So for each month of the year, if you take the global mean temperature for that month for the 20th century, and then look at the individual monthly global means, starting 353 months ago, they're all greater than up to the present day. So that's the equivalent of flipping a coin 353 times and it coming up heads every time. If you assume that there's no trend and that all other things are equal. So the next item is the 14 warmest years globally have all occurred during the 16-year period, 1998 to 2013. So that's another thing that's very unlikely to happen by chance. On the other hand, climate change deniers like to point out that global air temperature trends have been level since 1998, or at least not statistically significant. So that's really true. I think it's overridden by the previous statement. 14 warmest years occurred during that time, so it's a very high plateau that it's reached. We have very good reasons to expect. We don't really know which year, but trend will start going back up again. The trends in ocean temperature, Arctic ocean ice and Greenland ice, are still there in the 1998 to present period. So let's talk about the idea of what a scientific theory is. It's a much stronger word among scientists than it is among the general public. So it's an explanation of observed occurrences with a lot of evidence backing it up. It's particularly useful if it can be used to predict future occurrences. If not, it's not a very good theory. I'm calling it particularly elegant if it can be written as a mathematical equation. So an example that's written as a mathematical equation, Newton's laws of motion, F equals ma, pretty easy mathematical equation. The next example is a sentence, sexual union between male and female deer often results in young deer. That seems like a fact, right? So, you know, for all intents and purposes, it's a fact. But in science talk, technically it's a theory. The evidence that we have up to this point supports it, but we haven't seen every single case, and we don't know if there might suddenly come a time when this is no longer holds true. So we haven't exhausted all the possible cases. You can disprove a theory, but never absolutely prove it.
Can I ask a quick question?
Yeah.
How long have they been recording temperatures? Because you said globally, 1998.
Yeah.
How far back has that been documented?
Those temperature records that we're comparing to go back to 1895.
Okay. When they started.
So, yeah, it's...
And globally. That's 1895 globally?
Yes.
Okay.
So that is... Up to 2013, that is 119 years. And the 14 warmest of those occurred.
Since 1998.
Yeah. Okay, so to create a scientific theory, the classical way to do it is to have control and experimental groups that you can compare, and really the archetypal way, one of the clearest cut ways of doing this is clinical drug testing. So you have a placebo group and a actual drug test group, and compare the two, see how well they come out, and you start out with a hypothesis that says, well, we think this drug will work. Do the experiment to generate evidence, and then you come out with a theory, and in that case, possibly a commercially viable drug. In the case of climate change, we know that we have increasing atmospheric CO2, but we don't have a control case in which there's an Earth without that increasing amount of CO2. So it's a real-time, uncontrolled experiment in terms of the actual Earth. But then what we can use is computer models. So what are they? We can build computer algorithms or models based on well-tested pieces of scientific knowledge, and these all have the status of theories, but they are supported by great mountains of evidence. And so the models will then represent surrogate Earths. So you can ask them various what-if questions by putting different inputs into the model. And these provide the equivalent of control and experimental cases. And without making this connection, using models and theories, the observed climate change would be of a mysterious source. We can see that it's there, but we really need these models to give us a good idea of what the cause is. So in order to build a model, the saying goes, garbage in, garbage out. And therefore, you need good theories to base these models on.
Oh, great. Now something I understand.
All right. So the scientific basis has a long history. And the only purpose behind putting these equations on there is to show that that these are theories with an elegant form, and the people who are trained in these things understand them. They can be summed up in just a line rather than page upon page.
So in 1786, they were beginning to put that together, the biochemistry and plus human activity?
Yeah. Priestley was the one who really measured the chemical constituents of the atmosphere.
Wow.
And I don't think it was Priestley himself, but people were beginning to understand that carbon dioxide was going into the atmosphere from combustion.
And where is he from? Or where was he from?
Priestley was British.
Okay.
Actually, once you started asking that, I'll jump to the question I was going to save for the end of this slide. One of the names on this slide appears in the, I don't know what it's called, the ELCA calendar of saints' days.
The days that... Is it Euler?
It's Euler.
Euler. E-U-L-E-R?
Yeah. So he was of Swiss origin, but spent a lot of his career in St. Petersburg, Russia.
Oh,
And I saw his grave there a few years ago.
Wow.
So why is he in the bulletin?
He's a saint.
Yeah, he shares a day, I think it's in May, with Copernicus. And I think maybe that's the only scientists that appear on that. So, I don't know, it's Lutherans honoring the contribution of science to society. So the second line is thermodynamics, and Helmholtz is the person I've listed there. And the equation there basically says that the total amount of energy in a system never changes. It can switch from the form of light into heat energy of air, or energy due to evaporation, or heat up some water at the surface. Those are the things that are really important in the climate system, but there's also kinetic energy and potential energy, electromagnetic energy. So this theory of thermodynamics includes all of those. It's an important piece of understanding climate change. The next line, I'm calling it by several names, optics, radiative transfer, spectroscopy, and quantum mechanics. And this is just the idea of light coming from some source. For us, really, the main ultimate source is the sun. And that light being absorbed, reflected, emitted by various pieces of the Earth system, and traveling around and being absorbed. So this is the 1814 of the title of this talk. Fraunhofer was the discoverer that if you break the sun into a spectrum, sunlight into a spectrum, there are little dark lines in that spectrum. And that means that the atmosphere of the sun is absorbing the light at those wavelengths. So that was the beginning of what we call spectroscopy. And that was later extended to the invisible parts of the light spectrum, the thermal infrared, and they begin to understand that somewhat larger molecules could absorb light at discrete wavelengths in the thermal infrared. So included in that is carbon dioxide, and it's actually a vibration of the various atoms of carbon dioxide molecules. And the equation there, the theory behind the spectroscopic lines came later in the form of quantum mechanics, and the equation there is known as the Schrödinger equation. So he was the one who formulated the equation that governs how atoms and molecules can absorb energy or absorb radiative energy, sunlight and infrared radiation. And then another piece that is has some importance but actually is not quite as fundamental to climate change is the contribution of Euler fluid dynamics. So that just governs how air will flow, and that was kind of covered in my Monday presentation, the job of the atmosphere, how air flows around in response to heating and cooling in various places. So they started putting it all together, and unfortunately this is not quite so elegant, so I don't have a single equation in the right column for this, but the greenhouse effect, the natural greenhouse effect, was first studied by Tyndall, and he published about that in 1859. Arrhenius was a Swede, and he published about his understanding of the effects of carbon dioxide from coal burning on the temperature of the Earth and the atmosphere. He didn't quite include all of the relevant processes in there, though, so he underestimated it relative to what we think of now. Manabe and Wetherill, 1967, is what I think of as the beginning of the modern understanding of climate change induced by carbon dioxide. So actually, I'm going to skip that one, and really, I mostly explain this one. The implications on the first line biogeochemistry. There's a slow and weak natural compensation for the addition of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. So humans are really overcoming that.
Under, I don't know what you mean by that.
Pardon me?
What do you mean by humans are overcoming what?
Humans are emitting CO2 much faster than natural processes can remove it from the atmosphere. And under optics and radiative transfer, the gases with at least three atoms per molecule, so CO2, H2O, are the biggest examples. They're speed bumps for heat leaving the Earth atmosphere system. So then if we go on to look at the thermodynamics, that means that the Earth is not losing as much heat as it has coming in. Temperatures become warmer. The fluid dynamics refines the distribution of temperature around the globe. It's just kind of a redistribution of that heat. And this also influences storms and precipitation. So putting it together again, Tyndall discovered natural greenhouse effect. He was mainly thinking in terms of various amounts of water vapor in the atmosphere at different times and places. Fossil fuel caused enhancement that was started by Arrhenius, but some of the processes that led to the more modern understanding are water vapor feedback. So if you get warming, you get more water vapor into the atmosphere as well. That itself is a greenhouse gas. It's a multiplying effect. And mutual warming by the surface and the atmosphere. So if you think of it as just warming the air, that's only part of the story, so you haven't got the full effect of coupling between the surface and the atmosphere. So this is kind of the key figure from Manabe and Wetherill, 1967, and the way they actually displayed it, it more prominently shows what's happening way up in the atmosphere, and what's happening near the surface is kind of this more vague part of the figure, but they're showing that near the surface, increased carbon dioxide as multiplied by the effect of water vapor contributes to warming. So what it tells us, warming troposphere, lower atmosphere, due to increased CO2, and the opposite too, they actually had a decreased carbon dioxide case, cooling due to that, and coupled surface atmosphere action is a major contributor to that. One without the other is not very effective at warming the atmosphere. It's enhanced by water vapor feedback, as I said, and someone wants to talk about it offline. Actually, the opposite is happening in the stratosphere. So above about 10 miles up, it's cooling due to increased CO2, warming due to decreased CO2. What this study doesn't tell us is what the geographic distribution of that warming is. It's representing the whole atmosphere as just one column and one time. So therefore, there's no evolution by decade. It's just got a couple of discrete amounts of CO2 concentration. Effects specific to the season are not shown here. And any impacts other than air temperature are just not covered by this. So now going on to a little bit of the concepts of our overall understanding. I call climate the backdrop. So if it's a play, you've got a backdrop for Hamlet, and you know he might come out and say, to be or not to be, that is the question. But if you start changing the backdrop enough, you might end up having someone saying, I've always depended on the kindness of strangers. So if weather is the action, you might have different events going on at any one time, but they all fit within that context of the climate. Weather is really not predictable beyond about 2 weeks, but it pretty much stays within that climate envelope. And greenhouse gases are one of the things that define that envelope. A few of the other things that help to define climate, mostly over much longer time periods, but one example for a shorter time period, and it's almost so obvious that people forget when they're thinking about climate change, but time of year is a natural cycle of climate. Of course, it's colder during winter than summer. Teleconnections such as El Nino, that's the most famous one, those can have some effect over the time periods around 2 to 30 years. Major volcanic eruptions. Pinatubo was one of the more recent examples. Those can have effects lasting around 2 years. Sunspot activity has cycles around 10 to 500 years, but does not have the magnitude that we're expecting from CO2. Orbital characteristics, this is known as the Milankovitch cycle and causes the ice ages on time scales of around 50,000 years. And also a major contributor over very long time periods is plate tectonics, the arrangement of the continents. And one of the most recent changes in this that is thought to be influential was the closing of the Isthmus of Panama. We wouldn't have El Nino and sort of the mean pattern that's associated with it unless we had that closure between North and South America. So quickly, here are some of the predictions. The top row is showing changes in air temperature going out into the future at various time horizons. So the closest one is on the left, and this is showing latitude versus height. So in all of these cases, the biggest change in temperature is occurring quite high up in the troposphere near the equator, but there are also significant changes at the surface as well. And actually you can see the blues up even higher. That's the stratospheric cooling that I was talking about earlier. So the relatively simple model of Minabe and Weatherall was predicting that, and these more sophisticated models that are much newer are also showing that. And also keep a bookmark on that stratospheric cooling for Friday's presentation as well. So this is a large number of models from various modeling centers around the world that are put together for these composite projections. So the top is the atmosphere, the bottom is projections for the ocean. And the largest amount of temperature change is predicted at the surface of the ocean. These are projections of changes in temperature starting from 2000. This is actually a little bit out of date. Under various scenarios of emission of carbon dioxide and the largest amounts of emission show the highest changes in temperature. The one shown in orange is labeled year 2000 constant concentrations. So in this scenario, this is a what-if scenario. They said, we know what the concentration was in 2000. If we go out into the future and maintain that as a constant CO2 concentration in the atmosphere, there's still a little bit of an upward trend here. There are also some wiggles. That's some of the noise that occurs within the models and mimics natural variability. But this is still going upward, and that indicates that climate is out of equilibrium, and the oceans still need to catch up. The oceans are still absorbing a lot of that heat that's excess at present. Among these other scenarios that are considered somewhat more realistic, they mostly stick together until about 2050, and after that start to diverge. So that's one indication that early action is good. Now this is getting back to observations, and this is for a relatively short time period, but where I come from in Michigan, there is this perception regarding this last winter. So this is January through March of 2014, and the darkest red says record warmest temperature in this region. Dark blue says record coldest, and that's happening right over Michigan.
Yes, it is.
So yeah, we did have unusually cold temperatures, but most of the world is showing up as red. So just looking at one place and a relatively short time period is not really a good indicator of long-term trends. You've got to look at.
Are the colder spots because of that redistribution that's happening?
Yeah, I guess, yeah, you could describe it that way. So they called it the polar vortex. I have some objection to that exact term. But basically what happened was there was more air blowing out of the north during that time period than there usually is. And that is a redistribution of that heat.
Do you have a sense of what the poles were doing this year? I mean, they're just not listed there. Do you have a sense of where they were? Where they typically?
Yeah, I really don't know what to say about that. So yeah, those are shown here as regions without enough observations that they wanted to report them on this graph. So let's quickly talk about things to do about it. Energy efficiency in transportation, industry, and residential. So think about all of those things. Use less stuff. That's unpalatable for a lot of people, but that is a solution.
That's your scientific language there. Use less stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
When you say stuff, do you mean like gasoline? What would you mean?
I guess I'm thinking more in terms of manufactured goods that that directly consume energy in the industrial sector. But gasoline would be good too. Yeah, so energy efficiency in terms of transportation would be using less stuff, building fewer exurbs and houses that are a long way from where people want to end up for work and entertainment. That's another issue. Renewables, solar, wind, wave and tide. So yeah, this is not my real area of expertise. Biofuels kind of had a fad, but there have been some problems with the way that they've been produced, such as growing sugarcane by tearing down Amazon rainforest. So yeah, they're not quite as unequivocally good as
corn and ethanol.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's an issue with taking that supply away from the food supply. Nuclear. James Hansen is one who particularly advocates using more nuclear fission. So that's the old kind of nuclear energy. And there are ups and downs with that. Fusion is still considered to be in the future, so that's hydrogen-fueled nuclear energy, and if it can be successfully harnessed, it's a huge energy source. But the joke about it is they keep saying that it's 20 years into the future. So when I was in graduate school in atmospheric sciences, there was also a major research facility right next door that were working on fusion energy, and their joke is it's always 20 years in the future. So yeah, that was over 20 years in the past, and here it is that long in the future, and still no real fusion energy production. And sort of the political action, personal support for awareness, and policy-based incentives.
Question. Can you just briefly summarize how these things to do actually will change or fit into the causes of the climate change? I mean, these are things to do, but what are they affecting, really?
They are affecting the amount of carbon dioxide being emitted into the atmosphere.
Okay.
So, yeah. So, actually, the next bullet point says there is no silver bullet, but silver buckshot. I forget who to attribute that quotation to, but I didn't come up with that.
So what do you attribute the delay for the nuclear fusion? Is it money?
They just haven't perfected the technology for it. I don't think it's politics, you know, maybe some more money would help, but I'm not sure. Yeah, the idea is they have to contain charged particles at very high temperature and just smash these hydrogen nuclei together, and if they fuse, then that releases energy. And they haven't figured out how to do that without putting more energy into the system than comes out.
Right, you get a sense in your work that I feel like there's an abundance of information that we are still, there's abundance of information that says this is what's happening, so that's a fairly given. Do you get a sense in the scientific community there's starting to be a change towards a focus on kind of developing some alternative strategies to deal with this?
I'd say it's largely a separate community that's dealing with that. So yeah, and there are experts on different aspects of this. So the basic science is really my sphere, and you know, I can talk to this things to do about it a little bit, but it's not my usual area.
How do you keep hope alive when you're dealing daily with the fact that, I mean, you're seeing the proof of the change?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, I'll
deal with your projections to a future.
I'll go on. I have just a few resources that I'd like to mention. And I didn't order any of these for the bookstore, but books that I like are Storms of My Grandchildren by James Hansen, which is presenting the science as well as the personal experiences of this scientist. So I kind of resonate with those personal experiences, and as well as the science is good. Merchants of Doubt is about how certain parties have tried to cloud everything with doubt, and you know, even though they can't say much factual, that they can spread doubt. A few of the websites, the first two are government agencies. NOAA's is called climate.gov, and then there's an EPA one. The next two are kind of independent websites. One is called Skeptical Science, and the other is called realclimate.org. And then, as an example of a non-governmental agency, I've got National Wildlife Foundation, Federation.
Federation.
Yeah. Yeah, but there are many many NGOs that have websites, and Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. That's the international organization that publishes these big volumes that kind of pull a whole lot of information together, and they're getting better at having more public accessible, understandable materials there than in the past. And a couple of the things that give me hope on this page that I'm calling media coverage, I would say Rolling Stone, The Turning Point, New Hope for the Climate, is written by Al Gore, and like I said, I don't take marching orders from him, but I liked what he said in there about how it really does seem that more people are concerned about this, and that the economics of the solutions and alternative types of fuels, that sort of thing, is looking better. I was not quite so thrilled with his using individual storms as examples, and you know, he really didn't say this is direct evidence for climate change, but he kind of said, well, this happened, and kind of let that as a little bit of an implication. So that's a fussy scientist talking about that. And the Climate Swerve is more recent. That was in the New York Times, and that actually says similar things about people's attitudes and the economics of solutions. So there are pictures of some of the scientists I was talking about, and Manabe is still living. He's, I think it's later this month, he's 83 years old.
Is he still active in the community?
Not really, no.
After 82 as a scientist, you kind of...
That's it.
Done.
You even think so, huh?
More questions?
Have you heard of it's a compilation, and it's called Hope Beneath Our Feet. I think Martin FLOEG, I think is his name, did the compilation mostly because he was really concerned about climate change, environmental changes,
mm-hmm.
And he had young children. So he put it out there, and there's several people that basically submitted writings or gave permission to have their writings published. And I got it if you want to look at it.
Okay.
But it's really interesting because it's broken up into kind of what is, what's going on, what have we done about. I mean, it's just different sections and stuff like that. And it's some of them are really discouraging. I mean, one mm-hmm. guy, he just is really discouraged. But other ones are, they have just a little bit of hope. And Hope Beneath Our Feet is the title, so I haven't read all of them, but I shared it with several people here so far, and they thought it was a good compilation.
Yeah, there are a lot of things out there, and I don't know all of them, and you know, only put a small sampling in my list.
Well, I'd love to have you look at it to see if you know the people that were the people who wrote the essays and
yeah.
stuff. Yeah.
You made that understandable. Thank you.
Great, thanks.
Yes.